Could you at this time please make sure that your cell phone is either turned off or set in the vibration mode? Thank you. Each year, we commemorate the life and works of Madame Blavatsky. As a tribute to the work done, the message and teachings she brought back to the consciousness of man. We call this day White Lotus Day and remember her passing from this world on May 8, 1891. Looking back to mark the events, the accomplishments, the meaning she brought to the lives of those on the scene at that time, and to us continuing the efforts in the future through the writings collectively called Theosophy. The search for truth continues as our life's works, ever pointing us in the right direction was her life's work. Born in Russia to a family whose lineage can be traced back to the first royal Russian family, we find a soul whose life was extraordinary from the very beginning. Born into the world at a time when cholera was epidemic, the infant was considered delicate, and the family wanted to baptize her immediately. The ceremony was performed by a priest while relatives of Helena gathered around with lighted candles. One person was absent, so they had a young girl, an aunt of Helena's, take that person's place, and she was given a lighted candle. Within a short time, the child grew weary and sank to the floor, unseen by others. At the point in the baptism where the relatives are renouncing evil on behalf of the infant, the robes of the priest accidentally caught fire from the flame of the candle of that child seated on the floor. Chaos ensued, and several were burnt, but Helena survived. The symbolism was unmistakable, as the one newly born would blaze a trail to expose dogma and point to truth. Being born into a family with ancestral ties to the oldest ruling family in Russia, Helena was acquainted with many of the class of Russian nobility as she grew up. That connection would cause some to join the Theosophical Society by association with her later in life. Her life was one filled with mystery and unimaginable events. It was evident that she was not an ordinary person. As soon as she was old enough to understand, her nurses gave her the chief part in the Russian ceremony meant to gain favor with the spirits of the house. Her education was fragmentary and would later be more proof that her magnificent writings on deeply occult, scientific, and philosophical topics must have indeed been assisted by those unseen beings, the masters. As a young girl, she did not let convention stand in the way of what she wanted to do. It was said she would ride Cossack horses with a man's saddle, and she spent much time with her father on the fields of battle. In 1844, at the age 14, her father took her to London and Paris, where she learned music. Her father would later fund and make possible many more of her worldly travels. In 1848, on a dare, she married a much older gentleman, 22 years older than her, General Blavatsky, realizing too late that in Russia, dissolving a marriage was not possible. She soon left him and struck off alone to travel the world. Traveling by ship, there was a great commotion a shipwreck, and all but a few drowned. HPB was one of those who survived. Attempting to start a movement in Egypt that would investigate spiritualism and expose fallacies, it would take hold for 2 weeks only. Leaving Egypt, we find her traveling to America, Canada, Mexico, India, and occasionally returning home to Russia. It was during this time that she was trying to understand and gain control of her natural psychic powers, and many were to witness the wonders that would go on around her. She foresaw that the phenomena and spiritualism, if allowed to continue in our presently material civilization, would bring about moral and physical disaster. So the impetus for the Theosophical movement arose. In 1875, while in New York, she and Colonel H.S. Olcott and William Q. Judge started the Theosophical Society with the objects of making a nucleus for a universal brotherhood, the study of ancient religions and science, and the investigation of the psychical laws which affect man and nature. After becoming an American citizen, funds from Russia would stop coming, and she would rely on those working with her for the necessities. Mr. Judge tells us that she never accepted a penny for herself, but always continued on with the work. At this point, she began writing Isis Unveiled, and she was said to write day and night until it was finished and a publisher was found. Newspapers of the day in New York scoffed at her work and laughed at the propositions put forth by the Theosophical Society. But she and others worked on tirelessly. When Isis Unveiled was published, the newspapers gave her good reviews for all the research done, as shown in the many footnotes and referenced throughout the massive work. Yet, as attested to by Mr. Judge and many others who had seen her in the process of writing, there were no references at her avail at any time. It was said that these ideas came straight from unseen beings, with specific references to books found all over the world. In 1878, Madame Blavatsky felt the need to go to India and begin the work there that was now taking root in America. She and Colonel Olcott and two others went to India, stopping in London on the way. Seeing the three great points on the world's surface in the late 1880s as India, America, and England, attempts was made to start Theosophical Society in these places, and those places, with the idea that if they took root, the teachings could spread around the world over time. Finally arriving in Bombay, India, in 1878, Madame Blavatsky and her party were met by several Hindus who had heard of their coming. Lodging was sought out, and the work of starting the movement in India was seriously begun. For 9 years, HPB would work ceaselessly on writing the Theosophist magazine and would talk with all those who were interested in the ideas of theosophy whenever they called upon her. In 1887, feeling the movement was strongly rooted in India, so as to continue on its own, Madame Blavatsky would set out for England to start Lucifer magazine there. Once again, day and night she wrote, worked, spoke with inquirers as she had done in India and America. During this period in her life, she wrote The Key to Theosophy in 1889, The Voice of Silence, and her masterwork, published in 1888, The Secret Doctrine. And so, in 1891, Helena Petrovna Han Blavatsky laid down her mortal frame and passed from the scene of active life, leaving behind the legacy of theosophy. Her fervent wish was, be theosophist, work for theosophy. And today we honor the spirit and intention of the one called HPB, whether talking about theosophy or in describing Madame Blavatsky herself, we hear these fitting words. Theosophy is the shoreless ocean of universal truth, love, and wisdom, reflecting its radiance on the earth. This day, then, is a commemoration of the accomplishments of HPB, her writings which offer us a picture of hope for mankind and remind us of our responsibility for each individual. The Theosophical Movement begun in 1875, which united lives of theosophists throughout the world, continued to spread and broadcast, and her life, an example to us of courage and adversity, dedication and service to the cause of the greater good. You will now hear readings from three theosophical works, which HPB suggested would help us to develop the devotion and strength necessary to carry on the work begun by her. They are taken from The Voice of the Silence, The Bhagavad Gita, and The Light of Asia. After the readings, we will have a talk on her life and work, and finally, some time for fellowship and remembrance among ourselves.
Our first reading this morning is from The Voice of the Silence. Arhans and sages of the boundless vision are rare, as is the blossom of the Urumbara tree. Arhans are born at midnight hour, together with the sacred plant of 9 and 7 stalks, the holy flower that opes and blooms in darkness, out of the pure dew on the frozen bed of snow-capped heights, heights that are trodden by no sinful foot. No Arhan, O Lanu, becomes one in that birth when for the first the soul begins to long for final liberation. Yet, O thou anxious one, no warrior volunteering fight in the fierce strife between the living dead, not one recruit can ever be refused the right to enter on the path that leads toward the field of battle. For either he shall win or he shall fall. Yea, if he conquers, Nirvana shall be his. Before he casts his shadow off his mortal coil, that pregnant cause of anguish and illimitable pain, in him will men a great and holy Buddha honor. And if he falls, even then he does not fall in vain. The enemies he slew in the last battle will not return to life in the next birth that will be his. But if thou wouldst Nirvana reach, or cast the prize away, let not the fruit of action and inaction be thy motive, O thou of dauntless heart. Know that the Bodhisattva, who liberation changes for renunciation, to don the miseries of secret life, is called thrice honored, O candidate for woe, throughout the cycles. The path is one, disciple, yet in the end, twofold. We lost our place. The path is one disciple, yet in the end twofold. Marked are its stages by 4 and 7 portals. At one end, bliss immediate, and at the other, bliss deferred. Both are of merit the reward. The choice is thine. The one becomes the two, the open and the secret. The first one leadeth to the goal, and the second to self-immolation. When to the permanent is sacrificed the mutable, the prize is thine. The drop returneth whence it came. The open path leads to the changeless change, nirvana, the glorious state of absoluteness, the bliss past human thought. Thus the first path is liberation. But path the second is renunciation, and therefore called the path of woe. That secret path leads the Arhan to mental woe unspeakable, woe for the living, dead, and helpless pity for the men of karmic sorrow, the fruit of actions, the fruit of karma, sages dare not still. For it is written, teach to eschew all causes. The ripple of effect, as the great tidal wave, thou shalt let run its course. The open way, no sooner hast thou reached its goal, will lead thee to reject the bodhisattvic body and make thee enter the thrice glorious state of Dharmakaya, which is oblivion of the world and men forever. The secret way leads also to parinirvanic bliss, but at the close of kalpas without number. Nirvana's gained and lost from boundless pity and compassion for the world of deluded mortals. But it is said the last shall be the greatest. Samyak Sambuddha, the teacher of perfection, gave up his self for the salvation of the world by stopping at the threshold of nirvana, the pure state. Thou hast the knowledge now concerning the two ways. Thy time will come for choice, O thou of eager soul, when thou hast reached the end and passed the 7 portals. Thy mind is clear. No more art thou entangled in delusive thoughts, for thou hast learned all. Unveiled stands truth, and looks thee sternly in the face. She says, sweet are the fruits of rest and liberation for the sake of self, but sweeter still the fruits of long and bitter duty. I, renunciation for the sake of others, of suffering fellow men. He who becomes Pratyeka Buddha makes his obeisance but to his self. The bodhisattva who has won the battle and who holds the prize within his palm, yet says in his divine compassion, for others' sake, this great reward I yield, accomplishes the greater renunciation. A savior of the world is he. Behold, the goal of bliss and the long path of woe are at the farthest end. Thou canst choose either, O aspirant to sorrow, throughout the coming cycles.
A reading from the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna, what, O Keshava, is the description of that wise and devoted man who is fixed and constant in contemplation and confirmed in spiritual knowledge? What may such a sage declare? Where may he dwell? Does he move and act like other men? Krishna. A man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge when he forsaketh every desire which entereth into his heart, and of himself is happy and content in the self, through the self. His mind is undisturbed with adversity. He is happy and contented in prosperity, and he is a stranger to anxiety, fear, and anger. Such a man is called a Muni, when in every condition he receives each event, whether favorable or unfavorable, with an equal mind, which neither likes nor dislikes. His wisdom is established, and, having met good or evil, neither rejoiceth at the one nor is cast down by the other. He is confirmed in spiritual knowledge when, like the tortoise, he can draw in all his senses and restrain them from their wanted purposes. The hungry man loseth sight of every other object but the gratification of his appetite. And when he is become acquainted with the Supreme, he loseth all taste for objects of whatever kind. The tumultuous senses and organs hurry away by force the heart even of the wise man who striveth after perfection. Let a man, restraining all these, remain in devotion at rest in me, his true self. For he who hath his senses and organs in control possesses spiritual knowledge. He who attendeth to the inclinations of the senses, in them hath a concern. From this concern is created passion. From passion, anger. From anger is produced delusion. From delusion, a loss of memory. And from loss of memory, loss of discrimination. And from loss of discrimination, loss of all. But he who, free from attachment or repulsion for objects, experienceth them through the senses and organs with his heart obedient to his will, attains to tranquility of thought. And this tranquil state attained, therefrom shall soon result a separation from all troubles. And his mind, being thus at ease, fixed upon one object, it embraceth wisdom from all sides. The man whose heart and mind are not at rest is without wisdom or the power of contemplation. Who doth not practice reflection hath no calm. And how can a man without calm obtain happiness? The uncontrolled heart, following the dictates of the moving passion, snatches away his spiritual knowledge, and the storm, the bark upon the raging ocean. Therefore, O great armed one, he is possessed of spiritual knowledge whose senses are withheld from objects of sense. What is night to those who are unenlightened is as day to his gaze. What seems as day is known to him as night, the night of ignorance. Such is the self-governed sage.
From the Light of Asia by Sir Edwin Arnold. Pray not. The darkness will not brighten. Ask naught from the silence, for it cannot speak. Vex not your mournful minds with pious pains. Ah, brothers, sisters, seek. Naught from the helpless gods, by gifts in him, nor bribe with blood, nor feed with fruit and cakes. Within yourselves, deliverance must be sought. Each man his prison makes. Who toiled a slave may come anew a prince, for gentle worthiness and merit won. Who ruled a king may wander earth in rags, for things done and undone. Higher than Indra's, ye may lift your lot and sink it lower than the worm or gnat. The end of many myriad lives is this, the end of myriads that. Only while turns this wheel invisible, no pause, no peace, no staying place can be. Who mounts will fall, who falls may mount, go round unceasingly. If ye lay bound upon the wheel of change, and no way were of breaking from the chain, the heart of boundless being is a curse, the soul of things fell pain. Ye are not bound. The soul of things is sweet. The heart of being is celestial rest. Stronger than woe is will. That which was good doth pass to better, best. I, Bood, who wept with all my brother's tears, whose heart was broken by a whole world's woe, laugh and am glad. For there is liberty. Ho, ye who suffer, know, ye suffer from yourselves. None else compels, none other holds you, that ye live and die and whirl upon the wheel and hug and kiss its spokes of agony. Its tire of tears, its nave of nothingness. Behold, I show you truth. Lower than hell, higher than heaven, outside the utmost stars, farther than Brahm doth dwell. Before beginning and without an end, as space eternal and surety sure, is fixed a power divine, which moves to good. Only its laws endure.
Good morning. It is with gratitude that we come together today to show our respects to a woman who was born August 11th, or was it the 12th, at midnight, and who brought to the world, or back to the world, this ancient teaching called theosophy. In the Gita, there's a word called Adi Yajna, the great sacrifice. And that great sacrifice is myself in this body. That word exemplifies HPP's life, for she sacrificed everything for an ideal. And she ever kept this ideal burning alive in her heart and mind. And this became her impetus for work, to serve humanity, to give man his rightful place in this world of change. The sacrifice, she sacrificed her personal life for this greater work. In the secret doctrine is found an allusion to the great watcher who stands in the darkness, waiting for that tired pilgrim who had been wandering for lifetimes after lifetimes, looking for that light. And he waits and serves as a guide for those few who come that way. There's also in the secret doctrine, it tells us that the yogis themselves are voluntary victims in order to redeem humanity. These beings who sacrificed their impersonal individuality for their individual personality. We have in the world the archetypes of these sacrificing beings: Buddha, Krishna, Christ, Arhats, and adepts, who we know and we have heard stories of all of our life. HPB says to her students that there is no duty nobler than self-sacrifice. None. So, if she was that great sacrificer, she is much like a mother who nurtures and cares for her young, though her children who do not know. And she is ever present in our lives. When we come to speak of her, we are told of her history of her physical being. But that's only a small portion of who she was. And the meaningful part is that higher nature, that ability that she had to bring to the material world this ancient knowledge. The burden is heavy, for we know as mere fledgling students how heavy the burden is. For we have no respite in the world in which we live because no one knows us or understands us because no one understands themselves. And that we stand as a shining light of the nature of humanity, not individually, but collectively. That realization that we are a constant, eternal, boundless, immutable force. We are the witness of this ever-changing universe. Not because we are special, because we are that. And we are all that. We are all embodied spirit. We are all these eternal pilgrims looking for their way home. And our mother came to show us the way. In the sense that we hold the relationship we have with HPV with gratitude and respect and thankfulness in regard of not her path, but the path that she points out. we're often overwhelmed with our own particular problems and stresses of life. But there's a story of how she wrote Isis Unveiled. She had not yet started the Theosophical Society. It was a few years earlier when her teachers asked her to write for them and put down these ideas. Well, she had no idea whether it was just a paper they wanted her to write or maybe a booklet, a pamphlet. Well, it turned out to be 1,300 pages. Now, some of this she composed from her own background. Some of it was dictated by the elder brothers. But when she was finished, the Theosophical Society had begun, so she took the manuscript to Colonel Alcott. And Colonel Alcott read it and said, "Well, that what you received from the masters is fine, but everything else has to be edited and rewritten." And she looked and she said, "Okay." So with the help of Colonel Alcott and some students, she went back and rewrote those portions which she had compilated on her own. This shows her tenacity, persistence, and this persistence is what we all have. We just manifest it in different ways. But if you didn't persist, would we not perish? We would. For persistence is what makes us go forward and not fall back. Even though we may, we remember her admonishment. No matter how many failures you have, 20, 30, try. Just keep on trying. Because that one success may be that turning point for future endeavors. But always try. She wrote The Key to Theosophy, which put before the public those ideas which theosophists and theosophy considered to be the fundamentals of this philosophy. But in writing The Secret Doctrine, we are often put back, frightened to wander into that ocean because it looks so dark and deep, and we do not know if we could possibly comprehend what is written here. So as students, we often run from this book. We run to Mr. Judge. "Help. Help me open my heart so that my mind can see the truth." Mr. Crosby is another friend that took up the cause that HPB so royally laid out for us all. But HPB said that much of what she garnered and wrote down was from the Astrolite, or from directly from her teachers. And she said, "I bring but a bouquet that are not mine, but only the string which ties them together." And we thought, string? Well, where does the string begin? And where does the string end? Well, she showed us there is no beginning to that string, and there is no end. It is constantly wrapping together these ideas. We had, in our studies of comparative religion, which help us understand that we are not different, that we are all the same, the truth is all coming from the same source, and that religions point to the fact that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, but in our very nature, because religions point to a higher nature in all man. And that's what makes us as gods, because HPB says that we are the only gods on this earth, is man. That one of her objectives was to form a nucleus of universal brotherhood. And we sometimes, well, how do we do that? Well, we look to her example. She formed the Theosophical Society with Colonel Alcott, William Q. Judge, and herself. But this is where she stood in that organization. Mr. Alcott was the president. Mr. Judge was counsel. And HPP was the corresponding secretary. She was always the force, the persistence behind the dissemination of this ancient philosophy again. So, what can draw us to Theosophy? What can help us embody the ideas of Theosophy? Well, only we can do that by this person sitting up here, or by the persons who spoke with us and read to us. They can only project these ideas into the air, into the ether, into this vital force that surrounds us. It is a vibration of hope and a vibration of responsibility, that we are, as stated, are the source of our suffering and also the source of our happiness, that we are the creators of the universe. The universe unfolds from within outward. We are that universe. We are unfolding from within outward. So, what is inside of us? Well, our ideas. Ideas which we foster. HBB says there is one ideal, and that is of oneness, of unity, of brotherhood. But how to form that nucleus of that universal brotherhood? Well, through a recognition of that eternal, boundless, immutable, omnipresent aspect that we all are. To quiet that outer world. Not pay heed to the ramblings of the mind. Those pulls and tugs of our passions and desires. They are not who we are. They are the cobwebs or spider webs of our desires and passions that ever tie us to this life. In the same hand, they tie us to each other. So what one does affects us all. HPB knew that. That's why these truths have reverberated through the ages. That there is that substance principle, that on one hand is divinity, on the other hand is muliprakriti or substance. And it is through this process that the worlds come forth. That periodic emanation and withdrawal of that deific principle. HPB made it easy for us. She said, before you begin the study of this book called The Secret Doctrine, I'd like you to get familiar with certain ideas that will help you understand what is written here. Because it's not written for the mundane mind. Because when the mundane mind reads it, it wants to put it down. There's too many contradictions. There's too much to think about. Because the ideas that we grew up with are not found in this book. What's found are the truths behind everything that we know. And we come to learn that men, us, have a tendency to twist the truth. And we begin to learn that there are fundamental truths. But the truth cannot be told to us. We can be reminded of it. And then we must act as we see fit. Otherwise, it is not a living power in our life. It is only rhetoric, something that someone else told us, and we live in the shadow of someone else's thought. She asked us to consider that in our true self, as stated before, there is a principle that is eternal, that is boundless, that is immutable, and that is omnipresent. It's in our life. Do we know where it is? HPB said, find it. Make it your friend again. And live a life in spirit. For these bodies are not what we are. We are these dynamic generators of force. That we are electromagnetic beings who create the universe through their mind, their will, their imagination, their memory. All life is brought forth. So those ideas that we think about manifest. Thought, word, and deed. Many ancient religions are based on that precept. HPB taught no differently, that we are responsible. But to be responsible, we have to know who we are. Once we know who we are, the journey begins. Because we never really fully realize our complete potential. But HPB pointed to where they can be found. She said there are those race of beings who've perfected themselves in prior periods of evolution, who stand as the guardian for poor infant humanity. Their presence is always felt. It is that great white lodge of elder brothers. And we are shown again and again their presence amongst us. Buddha, Jesus, Zoroaster, Confucius, Paracelsus, many who have displayed powers that we think are magical. They are a freak of nature. They are abnormal. No. This is the normal process of humanity. And that is why in the Secret Doctrine, she addresses our intuition. Not our intellectual mind, which she challenges, but it's our intuition which she begins to awaken. That understanding which we have to develop through experience, through checking, testing, and verifying, that we know the answer. The answer lies within us. We are the source. Morality does not come from an outside God. Morality comes from within us. This brotherhood of humanity, which we are. And we are the nucleus of that humanity, of that brotherhood. For we share in these ideas of our oneness. But as life is periodic, so is our understanding of these ideas. For these ideas are cloaked in darkness for many, many generations. And then they come into the light again. And if we look in the history of man, we see this again and again and again. Our journey is to uncover the fact that we come into this world periodically, that this body of clay which we inhabit is only temporary, that there is this immutable, omnipresent, eternal aspect that never dies, that re-embodies, that reincarnates from life to life to life, so that every act and deed follows us. Every thought follows us. On that wheel of woe, yes, because our acts and deeds follow us. HPB says, turn to the Gita. Live in the moment. Be single-minded. Give up the fruits of your actions to that which is highest in all of us. Be unselfish to one day be selfless. But it is not a revelation that will change our lives. It is honest, sincere endeavor. Always trying. Always trying to realize who we are and act in accordance with that. If we study ancient religions and literature, we will see the unity. We will find that string on which HPB tied that bouquet of flowers which are found in the secret doctrine. But she also wanted to, for man to realize the occult side of life. That being this electromagnetic entity, we are living in a world of impulse, of ideas, and that we affect it by our very being. We think that because we understand this philosophy, we love these ideas, we think about them as much as we can. Who is it affecting? Well, it affects us, most certainly, but it affects the atmosphere around us. It affects those that come in touch with us. And the stronger we become, the stronger our friends, and the stronger that nucleus becomes. Because the occult side of life exists. She tells us, don't carry tales one unto the other. Nothing creates more ill feeling than that. Do not judge others. Be kind, be gentle. Love one unto the other. The fact that we are eternal beings, that we manifest from time to time, the fact that reincarnation and karma are laws, the laws of our very nature, we ask ourselves, why do we, or why are we here? Why are we doing this? What is this all about? It's for the emancipation of the soul. It's for those yogis who sacrificed themselves and entered into incarnation to uplift all of life. That is our purpose. There is none more nobler to aid life not to take from it, but to give to it. That is a hard concept for the Western mind to grapple with. We are not who we think we are. We are more than that. She told us to remember that these ideas are ancient, that many sacrifice much to keep these ideas alive, and at the last great cataclysm, these ideas were preserved, but then tested, checked, and verified by countless generations of wise beings and adepts. And HPB but gave a portion of that great learning for our perusal, for our understanding, for our emancipation. To suffer, we know we're alive, but we're alive in this lower world. There's a whole nother world that we're alive in. We have to nurture it. We have to know that it exists. We have to care about each other in little ways, because they become big ways. You must stop. When something has got us, stop and look at it and address it before it becomes into something bigger. Be ever vigilant to the mind, for that invisible force of will guides and directs our thoughts. How do you tell someone you love them? That it means something. Well, HPB did that. If you want to know her love, read her work, read her writings, understand her thoughts. In gratitude, we thank her. Meeting adjourned.